Chapter 45. Designs were forwarded, and finally accomplished by that same brother's active though unsuspecting assistance. Generation after generation, men, or women, guilty or innocent, through the action of their own will, or in spite of it, the curse has never yet failed of its victims. Never yet? But surely in our own time, dear father? I did not dare to put the question which was burning my lips. Have you never heard of the tragic end of my poor young uncles? He replied. They were several years older than my father. When boys of 14 and 15, they were sent out with the keeper for their first shooting lesson, and the elder shot his brother through the heart. He himself was delicate, and they say that he never entirely recovered from the shock. He died before he was 20, and my father, then a child of 7 years old, became the heir. It was partly, no doubt, owing to this calamity having thus occurred, before he was old enough to feel it, that his comparative skepticism on the whole subject was due. To that, I suppose, and to the fact that he grew up in an age of railways and liberal culture. He didn't believe, then, in the curse? Well, rather, he thought nothing about it. Until, that is, the time came when it took effect, to break his heart and end his life. How do you mean? There was silence for a little. Alan had turned away his head, so that I could not see his face. Then, I suppose you have never been told the true story of why Jack left the country. No. Was he is he is one victim of the curse in this generation, and I, God help me, am the other, and perhaps more wretched one. His voice trembled and broke, and for the first time that day I almost forgot the mysterious horror of the night before, in my pity for the actual tangible suffering before me. I stretched out my hand to his, and his fingers closed on mine with a sudden, painful grip. Then quietly, I will tell you the story, he said, though since that miserable time I have spoken of it to no one. There was a pause before he began. He lay there by my side, his gaze turned across me up the sun-bright, autumn-tinted glen, but his eyes shadowed by the memories which he was striving to recall and arrange in due order in his mind. And when he did speak, it was not directly to begin the promised recital. You never knew Jack, he said, abruptly. Hardly, I acquiesced. I remember thinking him very handsome. There could not be two opinions as to that, he answered. And a man who could have done anything he liked with life, had things gone differently. His abilities were fine, but his strength lay above all in his character. He was strong in his likes, and in his dislikes, resolute, fearless, incapable of half measures, a man, every inch of him. He was not generally popular, stiff, hard, unsympathetic, people called him. From one point of view, and one only, he perhaps deserved the epithets. If a woman lost his respect, she seemed to lose his pity too. Like a medieval monk, he looked upon such rather as the cause than the result of male depravity, and his contempt for them mingled with anger, almost, as I sometimes thought, with hatred. And this attitude was, I have no doubt, resented by the men of his own class and set, who shared neither his faults nor his virtues. But in other ways he was not hard. He could love. I, at least, have cause to know it. If you would hear his story rightly from my lips, Evie, you must try and see him with my eyes. The friend who loved me, and whom I loved with the passion which, if not the strongest, is certainly, I believe, the most enduring of which men are capable, that perfect brother's love, which so grows into our being, that when it is at peace we are scarcely conscious of its existence, and when it is wounded our very lifeblood seems to flow at the stroke. Brothers do not always love like that. I can only wish that we had not done so. About 5 years ago, before I had taken my degree, I became acquainted with a woman whom I will call Delia, apostrophe it is near enough to the name by which she went. She was a few years older than myself, very beautiful, and I believed her to be what she described herself, the innocent victim of circumstance and false appearance, a helpless prey to the vile calumnies of worldlings. In sober fact, I am afraid that, whatever her life may have been actually at the time, that I knew her a subject which I have never cared to investigate her past had been not only bad enough irretrievably to fix her position in society, but bad enough to leave her without an ideal in the world, though still retaining within her heart the possibilities of a passion which, from the moment that it came to life, was strong enough to turn her whole existence into one desperate, reckless straining after an object hopelessly beyond her reach. That was the woman with whom, at the age of 20, I fancied myself in love. She wanted to get a husband, and she thought me rightly ass enough to accept the post. I was very young then even for my years, a student, an idealist, with an imagination highly developed, and no knowledge whatever of the world as it actually is. Anyhow, before I had known her a month, I had determined to make her my wife. My parents were abroad at the time, George, and Lucy here, so that it was to Jack that I imparted the news of my resolve. As you may imagine, he did all that he could to shake it. But I was immovable. I disbelieved his facts, and despised his contempt from the standpoint of my own superior morality. This state of things continued for several weeks, during the greater part of which time I was at Oxford. I only knew that, while I was there, Jack had made Delia's acquaintance, and was apparently cultivating it assiduously. One day, during the Easter vacation, I got a note from her asking me to supper at her house. Jack was invited too. We lodged together, while my people were away. There is no need to dwell upon that supper. There were two or three women there of her own sort, or worse, and a dozen men from among the most profligate in London. The conversation was, I should think, bad even for that class, and she, the goddess of my idolatry, outstripped them all by the foul, coarse shamelessness of her language and behavior. Before the entertainment was half over, I rose and took my leave, accompanied by Jack and another man, Leggard was his name, who I presume was bored. Just as we had passed through into the anteroom, which lay beyond the one in which we had been eating, Delia followed us, and laying her hand on Jack's arm, said that she must speak with him. Leggard and I went into the outer hall, and we had not been there more than a minute, when the door from the anteroom opened, and we heard Delia's voice. I remember the words well, that was not the only occasion on which I was to hear them. I will keep the ring as a record of my love, apostrophe she said, and understand, that though you may forget, I never shall. Apostrophe Jack came through, the door closed, and as we went out I glanced towards his left hand, and saw, as I expected to see, the absence of the ring which he usually wore there. It contained a gem which my mother had picked up in the East, and I knew that he valued it quite peculiarly. We always called it Jack's talisman. A miserable time followed, a time for me of agonizing wonder and doubt, during which regret for my dead illusion was entirely swallowed up in the terrible dread of my brother's degradation. Then came the announcement of his engagement to Lady Sylvia Gray, and a week later, the very day after I had finally returned to London from Oxford, I received a summons from Delia to come and see her. Curiosity, and the haunting fear about Jack, which still hung round me, induced me to consent to what otherwise would have been intolerably repellent to me, and I went. I found her in a mad passion of fury. Jack had refused to see her, or to answer her letters, and she had sent for me, that I might give him her message, tell him that he belonged to her and her only, and that he never should marry another woman. Angry at my interference, Jack disdained even to repudiate her claims, only sending back a threat of appealing to the police if she ventured upon any further annoyance. I wrote as she told me, and she emphasized my silence on the subject by writing back to me a more definite and explicit assertion of her rights. Beyond that, for some weeks she made no sign. I have no doubt that she had means of keeping watch upon both his movements and mine. And during that time, as she relinquished gradually all hopes of inducing him to abandon his purpose, she was being driven to her last despairing resolve. Later, when all was over, Jack told me the story of that spring and summer. He told me how, when he found me immovable on the subject, he had resolved to stop the marriage somehow through Delia herself. He had made her acquaintance, and sought her society frequently. She had taken a fancy to him, and he admitted that he had availed himself of this fact to increase his intimacy with her, and, as he hoped ultimately, his power over her. But he was not conscious of ever having varied in his manner towards her of contemptuous indifference. This contradictory behavior, his being constantly near her, yet always beyond her reach, was probably the very thing which excited her fancy into passion, the one strong passion of the poor woman's life. Then came his deliberate demand that she should by her own act unmask herself in my sight. The unfortunate woman tried to bargain for some proof of affection in return, and on this occasion, at first openly declared her feelings towards him. He did not believe her, he refused her terms, but when as her payment she asked for the ring which was so especially associated with himself, he agreed to give it to her. Otherwise hoping, no doubt against hope, dreading above all things a quarrel and final separation, she submitted unconditionally. And from the time of that evening, when Leggard and I had overheard her parting words, Jack never saw her again until the last and final catastrophe. It was in July. My parents had returned to England, but had come straight on here. Jack and I were dining together with Lady Sylvia at her father's house, her brother, young Gray, making the fourth at dinner. I had arranged to go to a party with your mother, and I told the servants that a lady would call for me early in the evening. The house stood in Park Lane, and after dinner we all went out onto the broad balcony which opened from the drawing room. There was a strong wind blowing that night, and I remember well the vague, disquieted feeling of unreality that possessed me, sweeping through me, as it were, with each gust of wind. Then, suddenly, a servant stood behind me, saying that the lady had come for me, and was in the drawing room. Shocked that my aunt should have troubled herself to come so far, I turned quickly, stepped back into the room, and found myself face to face with Delia. She was fully dressed for the evening, with a long silk opera cloak over her shoulders, her face as white as her gown, her splendid eyes strangely wide open and shining. I don't know what I said or did. I tried to get her away, but it was too late. The others had heard us, and appeared at the open window. Jack came forward at once, speaking rapidly, fiercely, telling her to leave the house at once, promising desperately that he would see her in his own rooms on the morrow. Well, I remember how her answer rang out, neither tomorrow nor another day. I will never leave you again while I live. Apostrophe, at the same instant she drew something swiftly from under her cloak, there was the sound of a pistol shot, and she lay dead at our feet, her blood splashing upon Jack's shirt and hands as she fell. Alan paused in his recital. He was trembling from head to foot, but he kept his eyes turned steadily downwards, and both face and voice were cold, almost expressionless. Of course there was an inquest, he resumed, which, as usual, exercised its very ill-defined powers in inquiring into all possible motives for the suicide. Young Gray, who had stepped into the room just before the shot had been fired, swore to the last words Delia had uttered. Leggard to those he had overheard the night of that dreadful supper. There were scores of men, to bear witness to the intimate relations which had existed between her and Jack during the whole of the previous spring. I had to give evidence. A skillful lawyer had been retained by one of her sisters, and had been instructed by her on points which no doubt she had originally learned from Delia herself. In his hands, I had not only to corroborate Gray and Leggard, and to give full details of that last interview, but also to swear to the peculiar value which Jack attached to the talisman ring which he had given Delia, to the language she had held when I saw her after my return from Oxford, to her subsequent letter, and Jack's fatal silence on the occasion. The story by which Jack and I strove to account for the facts was laughed at as a clumsy invention, and my undisguised reluctance in giving evidence added greatly to its weight against my brother's character. The jury returned a verdict of suicide, while of unsound mind, the result of desertion by her lover. You may imagine how that verdict was commented upon by every radical newspaper in the kingdom, and for once society more than corroborated the opinions of the press. The larger public regarded the story as an extreme case of the innocent victim and the cowardly society villain. It was only among a comparatively small set that Delia's reputation was known, and there, in view of Jack's notorious and peculiar intimacy, his repudiation of all relations with her was received with contemptuous incredulity. That he should have first entered upon such relations at the very time when he was already courting Lady Sylvia was regarded even in those circles as a strong order, apostrophe, and they looked upon his present attitude with great indignation, as a cowardly attempt to save his own character by casting upon the dead woman's memory all the odium of a false accusation. With an entire absence of logic too, he was made responsible for the suicide having taken place in Lady Sylvia's presence. She had broken off the engagement the day after the catastrophe, and her family, a clan powerful in the London world, furious at the mud through which her name had been dragged, did all that they could to intensify the feeling already existing against Jack. Not a voice was raised in his defense. He was advised to leave the army, he was requested to withdraw from some of his clubs, turned out of others, avoided by his fast acquaintances, cut by his respectable ones. It was enough to kill a weaker man. He showed no resentment at the measure thus dealt out to him. Indeed, at the first, except for Sylvia's desertion of him, he seemed dully indifferent to it all. It was as if his soul had been stunned, from the moment that wretched woman's blood had splashed upon his fingers, and her dead eyes had looked up into his own. But it was not long before he realized the full extent of the social damnation which had been inflicted upon him, and he then resolved to leave the country and go to America. The night before he started, he came down here to take leave. I was here looking after my parents, George, whose mind was almost unhinged by the family disgrace, having gone abroad with his wife. My mother, at the first news of what had happened, had taken to her bed, never to leave it again, and thus it was in my presence alone, up there in my father's little study, that Jack gave him that night the whole story. He told it quietly enough, but when he had finished, with a sudden outburst of feeling he turned upon me. It was I who had been the cause of it all. My insensate folly had induced him to make the unhappy woman's acquaintance, to allow and even encourage her fatal love, to commit all the blunders and sins which had brought about her miserable ending, and his final overthrow. It was by means of me that she had obtained access to him on that dreadful night, my evidence which most utterly damned him in public opinion. Through me he had lost his reputation, his friends, his career, his country, the woman he loved, his hopes for the future, through me. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.